Hello and welcome to the second episode of Chips of Chorlton. This week I am joined again by Rob, Andy and Duncan. The venue is Rob's Kitchen and the fuel is provided by a 4-3 West Didsbury Chorlton win over local rivals Main Road. In this episode we have not one but two Dutch Uncle lowlights. We run the rule over Morrissey and Kanye. Andy and Dunk let us know what the chips are like at the bowling green. But to kick off, we talk about the best festival in Greater Manchester, if not the rest of the country. So three of us around this table went to Sounds from the Other City last night.
Sure did.
Which, did you have a good time? Robin and Duncan, you went, didn't you?
Yeah,
it was great, yeah.
Yeah, it was fantastic. First Indie Christmas comes about once a year.
Well, the way Chris Hawking, good friend of ours, Chris Hawking described it as, it's like it's your birthday, but it's like it's everybody else's birthday as well.
Yeah.
And I could kind of get that. Like, everybody is so happy and it's like just such a lovely vibe in a city that we don't spend enough time in. I mean, we're there most days of the week, but...
we are there most days of the week, yeah.
Yeah.
Or the King's Arms, you're saying? Yes, of course.
So what makes it so good, then, as far as... I know Chris Hawking thinks it's a great, great atmosphere. I mean, from my point of view, I think that's the first time I've been there since you played it.
Probably that's many moons ago.
10 years ago, are we talking?
It was 2010 when we played
okay,
it.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. That was the infamous set that Woo Life played there, and not that... You know, that went down in folklore as being like, oh, yeah, did you know Woo Life played there once? They didn't actually play there because in their rider it's stipulated that they don't play until sundown. And the only slot they could give them was at 5 o'clock. But I remember for years and years, Sounds of the City was always saying, oh, yeah, Woo Life played at the Old Pine Pot. You know, it's like, no, they didn't.
They did that.
But I just love that the legend became something there for a bit.
Yeah. So why has Sounds of the City survived and prospered where many other... inner city, Greater Manchester festivals have failed?
I think, first of all, it's not got too big for its own boots, I would say. I think it has...
It's never been about the lineup. You know,
that's
like,
true.
Like the people who go there, the bands are almost secondary to the session.
Yeah, there is never like a marquee act, is there? So it's never about that. Although, you know, you try and pick yourself a headliner. I think for myself this year, I went with WH Lung. Who was pretty much headlining the Old Pint Pot stage, just because I considered the Old Pint Pot stage to kind of be a very central focus of it. But then actually this year, I suppose it was more between Now Wave and Heavenly Recordings having their two stages. Who did you see? Who was your headliner, as it were?
Well, I mean, Duds. We saw Duds. Great. And they had that like extra ticketed system they had for the bands who were going to be more... in demand, basically. Yeah. So it's like Duds and Luxury Death and a few others. Like,
I think that came down to the chap who owns the factory just not wanting anyone to be in his factory.
Is that right?
Yeah, I think he thought if it isn't a ticketed system, it's just gonna, you know, everything will just run amok and everyone will be using the flushes in his toilets too much. And you know, he's counting them flushes, I think. Yeah.
Do you think it's still popular because it has a sort of DIY aesthetic still? And it's not really, it's completely unpretentious.
Yes, but I also think it's fortunate that Salford doesn't have the infrastructure for it to really get any bigger. Because there aren't any actual, you know, like sized venues. You know, if there was an 800 or 900 capacity sized venue in Salford, then I think that the people at Sounds would feel pressured to get that could fill that venue.
Yeah, it would turn into every other sort of city festival that happens now where you have a big headliner and then a list of bands that, you know... The gap is large between the bigger band and the smaller bands, you know, profile-wise.
And that's the case at a lot of small festivals, isn't it? You know, you see the festivals that, like Echo and the Bunnymen play every year, and like you see them at the top of the bill, and then you've not heard of any of the other bands on the bill. But like, you know, at least with this, there is...
It's better because of its limitations.
And also, given the size of the bands and the stature of the bands that are playing at Sounds from the Other City, I think it lends itself to be a lot more organised with the promoters that are at the different venues. Because I think once you do get bigger bands involved, and with bigger bands comes bigger demands and bigger fees and more people in the middle, you start getting more stage managers that are just rushing things along and not caring about how things are actually coming along. You know, if there's going to be a 15-minute delay, there just is, it sounds. It's not, it doesn't, you don't see anyone running around getting too stressed out, although I'm saying that there probably were some people stressing the fuck out at some point somewhere. But it seemed like it was very relaxed at this festival and not like another particular inner city festival we were just discussing, Deep Percussion Festival, RIP. When was the last time that happened?
It was many years ago. 2007,
wasn't it? We played the last one.
You were headlines at the time, weren't you?
Yeah. Did we play before the doors opened? Was that that one?
Sorry. You didn't let me spin the yarn on that.
Go for it.
Spoil the joke.
Oh, I can't remember it now.
Well, we played before the doors were open.
Well, okay, yeah.
But however, there was a band on before us.
Well, this is it. We were playing the second... Were we playing the High Voltage stage? I think we were.
Yeah. Right.
We were playing the one that was like underneath the bridge where the Deansgate Castlefield trams go over. That dock end there.
Yeah.
And yeah, we were the headlines back then, and we were like, oh my God, Deep Percussion, we have arrived, people. We are in the scene. They can't avoid us now. Seemingly, they can.
Yeah.
Yeah, we had some stage managers that were just like, yeah, I know the doors aren't open yet, but you're just going to have to go on stage because we're running late. It's like, how can the thing be running late if the doors aren't even open yet? And and I remember was Stephen managing us at that time?
No,
but I remember he was there. He was the first one through the doors to come and see us play, and we had three songs left. So we played five songs to no one and three songs to people coming in.
There was a band before us as well.
There was a band before us. Really poor band. Unfortunate bands. Yeah. Not poor as in everything else. They were called Air Cav. I think they're still going.
Oh yeah, Air Cav.
Yeah, Air Cav played before us. The bass player, I used to live with him. I was probably living with him at that time as well. Just thinking like, hard lines here, mate. Like, so only we watched them. And then nobody watched us because they were too miserable to do anything after their set.
Yeah, I think we did have like a moment backstage with them where it was a proper like, shit business.
We were definitely like eight Les McQueens there.
Yeah, yeah.
But what always makes me wonder...
18-year-old Les McQueens.
Always makes me wonder what people in the queue must have been thinking going on like, hang about, is that a band playing? We're not even allowed in the place yet.
Yeah. Because then after that we got offered the same summer to play that New Islington Festival, which was run by the same people. And it's like, well, you know, we played this one, surely another one can't be as bad. So let's do it.
Was this
another festival, right?
This is the guy who, well, the stage manager, because they had two tents, and one was like full on rock band tent, and one was quiet acoustic. So it's like, you cannot play when they play.
Oh,
you absolutely can't.
You can't sound check. You can't do anything. Because they've not even got microphones over there.
I think we'd got like a thumbs up from the front house engineer, like, ready to go. He's like, right, kick him in the first song. Stage manager in front of us, like, cut it. Don't play. There's an acoustic act still going on. Like, okay, sorry.
And then we played two songs.
And we played two songs, and then the festival was already running over, so we just cut the set.
That's it, guys. Yeah.
Then we probably came up and was like, oh, pretty good gig.
Better than Deep Percussion.
Yeah, isn't it?
We were going to do some reviews then, but we just depressed ourselves.
we figured as an Indie Matters kind of podcast,
we should do some. We should
talk about music at some point when we can get the chips off our shoulder.
Well, the chips this week are the Bowling Green in Chorlton. When were we there, Duncan?
We were there last Sunday, I want to say, watching United versus Arsenal.
Yep.
That was when we were there. And
we're not a football podcast.
We are not a football podcast.
It was a great result.
I ordered chunky chips and you ordered skinny chips, right?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Carry on.
So I want a bit of background about the Bowling Green as well. So it's just been refurbished, hasn't it? And we've been there probably regularly for however many years.
Quite a while now, I'd say. Maybe 4 or 5 years.
I'd say it's our go-to football pub.
Yeah. It's the big game pub.
And they've really big refit, haven't they? And their menu may have changed a bit. And have the chips changed, would you say?
Well, you ordered the chunky chips first?
I ordered the chunky chips.
Yeah, I was severely disappointed, unfortunately.
I was too.
Yeah, I thought it was a real soggy affair in general. No, it was though. Yeah. And I don't know, how do you...
I mean, I did put vinegar on them.
Yeah. As a pub
chip... Did you see me do
not
that?
Not that much.
Like, yeah, no, yeah. I'm, you know.
As a pub chip, I'd say the minimum that you expect is for them to be fried. Now, I have a suspicion that they might have been, like, oven-cooked in one of those big, like, industrial convection ovens.
Yeah.
Is my suspicion, because they weren't crispy.
Were they quite dry, or they...
No, they weren't. It was soggy. Right. It was weird. And as a pub chip... I think if you're going to serve chips in a pub, they've got to be a pub chip, which is at least once fried. Fluffed up a little bit and fried.
So like the sincerity in your eyes, I can see it. It's like this.
No, no, you're hurting. You're really hurting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, they just weren't good. I don't know. I didn't vibe them at all.
Yeah. For me, I found the fact that, I mean, the chip game's gone down. I thought they used to be better, to be honest. But now that they give you the choice of chunky or skinny, and for that makes me nervous as well, because I think that always comes down to atmosphere. For me, the Bowling Green is definitely a chunky chip atmosphere.
Yes.
I don't know what skinny I don't know what skinny chip atmosphere
is. It's not French fry.
You having a beer there, Rob? I had to go for chunky chips when I got them. And another thing that I found quite, you know, nerve-wracking about them was their kind of rustic shape, but no skin going on. You know what I mean? So I was a bit like, well, these are half moon cut, but then where's the skin with that? Like
they were just
manufactured.
Yeah,
to
it's definitely
like
you're just getting no love. I'm getting no love from them.
It had a real oven chip vibe. You know, like when you go around to your mate's house when you're 12 at school and you have like pizza and chips. It was like that, like a slightly undercooked
it's
oven
a grim chip.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah.
I know the one.
We were there before, weren't we? And don't they serve the chips in like the metallic kind of buckets now?
Yeah.
Which is a big fucking no from me, basically. So, you know, I just feel like you just put it on a plate. You shouldn't need to dress your chips up in like some sort of flowery metallic bucket.
And the little pot they've got with the barbecue sauce. Is it like the McDonald's pot?
Yes.
It is.
I noticed that actually on the plate.
It is.
Not that we were staring at the people next to us intently.
But they're not making them bigger. The idea is those that they open up. And they're not
opening
them
up. Actually, you flatten them up.
So, what are we saying? Out of five?
Well, should we do the French fries as well?
Well, I don't know. I mean, the French fries to me were a bit like the chunky ones, but...
I think the French fries
were a bit drier.
I thought they were slightly better.
You thought they were slightly better?
I thought I did, yeah.
But as an anonymous contributor to this debate earlier on today said to me, when you get the skinny chips and people start sharing, they're going for three at a time. But the chunky chips, they're going for one at a time. So depending on how much of a skint ass you want to be about, you know, or tight ass you want to be about your chips when, you know...
If you want to be Captain Tide.
Yeah.
Is the silver bucket like a quantity thing? Does it mask how little chips you're giving the customer?
I just feel it's a bit of a style over substance. I think if your food's good enough, you just need to serve it up. You don't need to put things separate. It's a very Jay Rayner kind of point of view, isn't it? I don't like slate plates. Sorry, Robin.
How do you feel about when it comes in like one of those fake like frying?
That's the worst.
I send them back. You look aghast, don't you?
Well, I mean, it's occurred to me just how much of a bridge we're burning here. Like, I'm going to be afraid to go into the bowler. Oh. Thankfully, it's the end of the season.
It's good for football, and it's nice. It's nice-ish beer.
What would you give them out of 10?
We're going on the decimal point score as well, aren't we?
Pitchfork.
We're going pitchfork. I want to do both. I want to do the chunky chip and the French fry.
Okay.
Chunky chip 4.8. I go.
Yeah, I'll say 5.4. Okay. On the chunky chip.
What about the French fry?
4.2.
I'm gonna go a bit more. I'll go 5.8.
Right. Wow. That's a real mixed bag.
Yeah.
And I'm afraid to go in there.
Yeah, me too.
There you go.
Thank you to the people who got in touch saying how much they liked the first podcast. In particular, Ben from Japan. We now know who Dutch Uncle's Japanese fan is, don't we?
Hi, Ben.
He got in touch.
Yeah, he got in touch.
But you were looking at the stats the other day.
Yeah.
And, you know, of the players we'd had... I think about 15% were from Japan.
Yeah, it's the third highest country. Yeah. So you've got, after the UK and the US,
so
Japan
unless it's
is the
just
third.
Ben listening over and
it's
over again.
It's not a cycle.
It'd be great if we never did a gig in Japan but did like a podcast tour.
Yeah.
I think
we actually offer that in our rates sometimes because, I mean, without putting a spoiler on how the industry really works, but sometimes you get given a good tour offer, but then the fee's absolutely dog shit. So you go, well, for £50 a show, we won't bring our instruments, but we'll have some microphones, we'll tell a few jokes. Yeah, yeah, we'll yeah. It's like, yeah, you see, Dutch Uncle's supporting comedy tour. Just yeah. Gonna, we're out in everyone tonight.
Half an hour set.
We're going to tell you what really happened.
But yes, so thanks to Ben. Cheers, Ben, for getting in touch. And if anyone else wants to get in touch, just do so at Chips Chorton on Twitter and at Dutch Uncles if you want to go to the band directly.
I think we should probably point out that we do want Chip recommendations.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah.
If
anything,
there's things that you think we should review, mainly accessible stuff for us, South Manchester.
Yeah, we've done a bunch too far.
And if there's any dreamers out there with starting out in bands that want to know anything about being in a band or any advice on what they would do in a particular situation.
Give up.
Well, you see, I mean, music's not quite full. It's getting there, but there's still a chance. And if there's anything that a band would want to know that we might be able to shed some light on, then please do, because without that, it will just be us kind of listing our greatest regrets, I think. Which is probably good listening in its own right, but maybe not all the time.
So any topics, just get in touch. So we're going to talk about Morrissey now. We're all
silence.
I know. I don't know where to start on this. So we're all Smiths fans, aren't we?
Yeah.
Yeah, and we like anymore. A lot of Morrissey's solo stuff as well.
Definitely. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. We do.
Well, he's got those. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Every now and then.
I've got more into it as time.
Yeah. Yeah. How do you separate the art from the artist?
Is this a personal thing? Like, I don't think I can do it personally.
Yeah. Okay. Why
I think
not?
Some people can. I think. But I don't know. I can't do it. I'm bitterly disappointed in him. In general, I'll dive straight in with it. He sold music on the premise of hating certain aspects of government policy at the time, and that government was a Tory government.
Yeah.
And he sold music on the premise of that, and a lot of people were angry, like he was, about certain policies. And I feel like with comments recently that he's made, which he's outing himself as a right winger, I feel like he's betrayed those fans who bought those records and sold them something that isn't true. And at the time, could we even is it a fact that he was a lefty? I don't know. Did he just hate the government?
Yeah.
But I don't think I think that's ambiguous.
Has he always just been like a wind-up merchant? Is he always just doing it for just to be the opposite of what?
It's some of the most powerful comments on society, on that Tory government in particular. Yeah. Well, and if he sold it on the basis that of a complete falsehood, then it's incredibly angry. I'm angry about it, and all Smiths fans should be as well.
Yeah. Well, I think an interesting pattern on his position with any topic that he deems to make controversial by opening his stupid mouth about it, well, you know, what it seems like, is that he only ever seems to pick things like, first of all, he'll always position himself in a way that he'll be able to say, oh, that's not what I meant, I didn't say it like that. And as you say, like in the 80s, you know, he was against the government. You know, you're talking about Thatcher when she was like, you know, at her most popular. He knows that's not going to change. He might have supported, you know, the Tories at that time.
Yeah.
But it's easy for him to be able to position himself like that because he knows that position's not going to change, and it's not something that he's ever going to come back to him, you know. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
it's I don't think he's ever really put himself out there, except for that bit where he started talking about the sabotaging of the UKIP leaders on Six Music, of all things.
No one gives a shit. Even if that wasn't a horrendous right-wing party, no one fucking cares. Yeah. It's a tiny political party.
But is he doing that because the left is much bigger now? Like the, you know, Corbyn and like Labour is like that side of Labour is much bigger now that he has to go the other way to kind of be heard.
No, I think it's all about him. It's all about his ego and what he thinks to be true.
Yeah.
I mean, to be honest, I've been ready to drop his substantially flaky arse ever since his biography came out. To be honest, I was really down with that book at first. I was kind of reading it with Google Maps open, Google. So I was reading it with, like, you know, like with like the map out, kind of going, oh, that's where his school was, and that's where that's, you know, because we live in Chilton and Stretford's area. So,
well, his house is two streets away from where we are at the moment.
Exactly. So the beginning of that book is fascinating, and then I was absolutely champing at the bit for the Smiths bit to kind of come into the story. And when he talks about the whole thing, he almost sounds a bit like David Brent about it. Like it was a foregone conclusion. Like this was just going to happen. You know, it was just meant to be like this. It's like, nah, I don't want to hear it like that. I want to hear it in the more, you know, I want to hear it when...
The more gritty.
I want to hear the moments where it nearly didn't happen. Yeah, because it nearly didn't happen for everyone, especially the ones at the top.
Absolutely, yeah.
And he's just not going to reveal any of that. And then the whole book just completely plateaus at the end. He goes, and then we went to Mexico, and everybody loved me in Mexico. And then we went to America, and everybody loved me in America. And it's like, yeah, we get it. Everyone liked you. And then I was in Rome, and everybody loved us in Rome.
You sound like The Godfather.
I don't know, that's not the goal. So, yeah, and the book was pants. And I was
I'm with you, I like the original description of Manchester and where we all live and what the record shops were like in Wally Range and that sort of stuff. That was great, but yeah, after that it was a bit fucking waffly.
Yeah, massive waffle.
Yeah. But yeah, I'm just hugely disappointed in the shit he's been saying recently.
So why does he sell lots of records, plays arena tours? How does that still happen? Is it something that, you know...
It's a legacy, isn't it? It's a cult fandom. But isn't that cult fandom built on sort of like him preaching about social justice and opposing...
Yeah, a lot of it is, but a lot of it is...
Opposing austerity.
Like the tunes as well, you know?
I don't know. With Morrissey in particular, when it's just Morrissey and it's all about the lyrics... The music's nothing to write home about.
Yeah, true. But then also his character, I think Israel has completely exposed him for the way that he'll love anything that sucks up to him, you know, anything that glorifies him. Yeah. Because I remember the only time I've seen Morrissey, thankfully it was a free ticket at the MEN, way up in the gods, and, you know, it was the typical Morrissey gig of like, right, he'll open on five bangers, Smith's songs usually, and then the rest of it's just unheard stuff that his record label won't release, usually with good reason. So it was a bit like that, but the talking in the middle was great. But he was talking about, he just kept reiterating the fact that I'm gonna do the voice again.
he was just
saying about how we've just come back from the city of Tel Aviv, where they've given me the key to the city, and Manchester Council have given me nothing. Like, he just kept saying it. And then everyone's just like, you know, it's funny. And then he says all these things, that how much he hates the royal family. Oh, yeah, whatever, it doesn't matter. But the thing is that, and then obviously after that, he's writing songs, obviously, about how inspired he is by Israel. And on the latest album, there is a song called Israel.
There is, yeah.
And I'm assuming it's a cheerful song about Israel.
I haven't heard it, to be honest, but...
That's what I'm guessing. Anyway, but the point is that, like, it just seems that, it's just like, well, you know, I don't know, I just thought that kind of exposed him for being like, yeah, well, you only like them because they gave you that key to this, because they love you, and so you feel, like, indebted and you just want to repay them. It's just a bit like, it shouldn't work like that.
I think in the most recent interview he did, the one on his website that is pretty fucking vile, to be honest. The word is, it really is.
Yeah.
But the thing that really got me and the real sort of little Englander that he is, when he talks about Sadiq Khan, and he talks about his accent.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's like,
yes.
Yeah, he's like, how do you have a London... How do you have a...
Oh, you don't speak like a London man.
How do you have a London man who can't even speak properly? Oh. Like, have you been to London, Morrissey?
Yeah.
It's like, that is what is known as a regional accent, or an accent within a certain aspect of a community. You know, it's incredible. Like, it's incredible how blinkered he can be about that.
Especially when the last mayor was Bojo.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's just like...
I was in Aldi the other day and I did struggle to find the eggs. So, like, there was one thing that I had a good point on, like...
Like, oh, yeah, mentioned eggs, didn't he?
Yeah, yeah.
But he used to love an egg. He used to fucking bang on about eggs.
but he can't find them.
But now he can't find them. Maybe that's it. Maybe that's it.
I could understand his anxieties in supermarkets, though. I've been tweeted about. I've been spotted in R. Morrison's eyeing up the vinegars. just because I couldn't find the pre-made hollandaise sauce. And I now have a condition. I can't go down that second or third aisle, whichever one it is, with the eggs and the vinegars.
Like, fucking hell, we're not famous. Like, but we've been spotted in supermarkets and people have tweeted about it. Rather than saying, someone tweeted like, oh, I just saw Robin in Aldi. Surprised he wasn't in Greg's.
It's couldn't like, find the eggs.
I know. Everyone just expects you in Greg's 24/7.
I got tweeted at when someone at a gig saw me come out of a toilet and not washing my hands.
It's you, isn't it?
Seen the joke from Dutch Uncles. He's just had a wee and he hasn't washed his hands. What a prick.
Reputation.
It's true.
I can't separate the artist from the art. And as a DJ, I feel particularly torn on this issue, especially doing 80s nights, where I really want to play the Smiths' Ask, and I'm just like, no, don't do it. But unfortunately, unless a raging Hindu came in and was just like, play Smiths, I'm just going to pick a name here, our Lindsay's loves it, you know, it's a hen. Like, you got to play the Smiths for
us. Do it in the Godfather voice.
We're gonna play some Smiths for us.
Yeah, anyway, yeah, Morrissey, prick, and unfortunately won't play the Smiths anymore.
So the reason why Morrissey is being a gobshite all of a sudden is because he's got something to promote.
Yes.
Indeed.
Bottom line, and we're sort of seeing sort of another degree of gobshitery, if you know what I mean.
Ooh, it's more of a misperceived meltdown.
Kanye's
always...
talking about Kanye.
Yeah, Kanye West, yeah.
Yeezy himself. Yeah. He's always been one to just be on his own wavelength, hasn't he? And with people have to realise that I don't think he's not a supporter of Trump's policies. He's a supporter of Trump as an idea of... I don't even want to try and defend where he's coming with it.
It's like defending his like capitalist like achievements.
And also coming from the rap world, I've seen an interview where Kanye does talk about before Trump was president, a lot of rappers would reference Trump as a sign of success. He'd always be like, you know, I suppose his name must rhyme with other things. But what was fascinating was to see this week on Twitter, and we are going to share this tweet from the Chips of Cholton.
Yes, we'll retweet it after this episode goes out.
We certainly will. It's a 21 tweet thread about the fact about the tin foil hat theory that what Kanye West is doing at the moment is very much a performance art piece, because he's been referencing the performance artist Andy Kaufman in a lot of his tweets, and he's also been talking about a particular artist from Europe called Joseph Beuys or Beuys?
Beuys?
I mean, to spell his last name would be B-E-U-Y-S, so make of that what you will. Yeah. Anyway, this artist did a piece called I Love America and America Loves Me. This is what the Twitter thread gets on about. And in this piece, what he did was he came over to New York and he stayed in an apartment with a wolf for 3 days, pretty much hiding from the wolf, from what I could gather. But at other times, he would confront the wolf. Now, the wolf is a symbol of... is like an American symbol, like an eagle. You know, the wolf is kind of like, you know, it is the... like the unicorn is to Scotland, did you know? That's some quiz knowledge. It's like a national figure. Anyway, the point being is that Kanye's approach to Trump is the same as Joseph's approach to the wolf. With this piece being titled I Love America and America Loves Me, the idea that we should confront ideas we are uncomfortable with compassion and love and an understanding. Why do people get to this point? Why do people feel that they need to vote for somebody like Trump to really stand up for their needs? Because it's really unnecessary. And that is kind of the right thing.
Yeah.
Maybe the album will reference this. Maybe the album won't. Who knows? Like, to be honest, with every Kanye song, I'm really into it until he starts rapping about his life with Kim. And then I just switch off because
It's a real, real fine line. So I think the quote that's really cut to the bone and really irked people is his quote about slavery. So I'm going to read
it. That's not part of this theory about Trump. The slavery thing is just a completely
Off the map. So this is word for word.
I'd love it if it was like this performance art piece. That would be amazing. Yeah. But like this completely goes against it.
So word for word, it goes, when you hear about slavery for 400 years, for 400 years, that sounds like a choice. You know, that's a direct quote from Kanye. I think that's... Is that really performance art for promotional reasons, you know?
Yeah, I think that bit just becomes a bit about stoking the flames, really. But at the same time, he has a particular glaze in his look when he says these things, I think, a lot of the time, where you just think he's just literally not checking his situation. The fact that a person like him can become as famous as quickly as he has and benefit from social media strategies, you know, he's one of the Kardashians, for God's sake, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, you know, they wrote the book on this. He's not, and he sees things like the student action against gun violence in America. He sees how quickly that can get organized. He sees those things and goes, he just doesn't realize, oh, why couldn't that happen for, you know, like back in the day? Why couldn't there be some sort of collective action? Why couldn't there be anyone saying, you know, we can fight back here? Well, it's because even 10 years ago, as we were saying before, you couldn't even make an event on MySpace, for God's sake. Like, it was, you know, it was all you could do on MySpace was sort out your top eight. Your top eight friends, like that's all you could do, and it just kind of, and maybe get like a snazzy wallpaper. And
Morrissey was in my top eight.
Morrissey,
there we go.
Might still be.
Check
it.
Who knows?
MySpace.com/StellaWazza
Oh God! Yeah.
So Joaquin Phoenix did kind of a similar kind of thing for that film that is, the names escape me again.
I'm Still Here.
Yeah, he did it with Casey Affleck, didn't he? So Joaquin Phoenix basically gave off the persona that he'd lost the plot in order for performance art.
I think Kanye really has lost the plot in some respects. But what Joaquin Phoenix did was a purposeful thing, approach that broke him, because he didn't act for 5 years after that. He took a serious break. He didn't return to acting until he did The Master with P.T. Anderson. So, like, it kind of, yeah, it just goes to show you what price Kanye will be paying, I suppose. And
if it is a performance art piece.
If it is a performance art piece, as we say, the album will have to explain something about this.
That's got to be the idea, hasn't it?
Yeah.
But like we say, like, the tweet about slavery is just so out of left field, as you say, you know, is that part of it? What relevance does that have? But the whole thing is about whether it is a... glorified marketing campaign for him, I guess.
Yeah.
And other artists have done it in the past as well, which we were going to come on to.
Oh, they have indeed. I think the one thing I don't get about that is that Kanye's already the biggest rapper in the world anyway, so I don't see why he would need to... In terms of promoting the album, I feel like he could just do this at any time, really.
Yeah.
So that's where I get confused with this performance art theory about what he's doing.
Yeah.
It's like, I mean, he can be changing the world for the good anytime he wants. He doesn't have to do it just because he's got something to promote, like everyone else that does things to promote things.
Yeah. Like us.
Like us. I mean, like, I think there's a few bands in the middle we've missed out there. You can go straight to us if you want.
Nobody in the middle. It's
just you and Kanye.
To be quick about it, you've got 1975. They're doing a very Taylor Swift thing
right now.
What
did they do?
They've shut down all their social media.
Well, they did that in the past as well.
They've done it in the past. Yeah. And they're saying, I think they shut down all their social media, just left one thing out there, just that said, one, disobey the rules. Two, look at your phone. Something like that. You know, it's cool people complaining about cool people. It is, to quote The Godfather Part 2, all part of the same hypocrisy. But Michael Corleone says that, so I'm not doing the impression. And then you've got Lily Allen is coming out. She's got an album in June, No Shame. And no matter what she's got to say about things, obviously this rumour's come out about her and Liam Gallagher, which she doesn't have to say anything. The fact that that's come out at the same time as the album is already suspect. But then also, she knows, as soon as she opens her mouth about any subject, the absolute vitriol she'll get. She's got so many haters out there that she knows, just like, you know what, just give me an interview, see what happens. Like, it's gonna go off. It always goes off, doesn't it? And then there was someone else. Who else is there? Who else is releasing an album?
Oh, there's another.
Who else is opening their gob other than us here at this podcast?
was it Blossoms today? Were we talking about them or before?
Well, they released their album last week, didn't they? Yeah.
Well, they had an ice cream van, didn't they?
Yeah, so, which
is kind of akin to something we do. We've had our fair share. Let's talk about our little stint.
Well, I mean, what was the first one?
So the first thing we did was we released a burger with our third
released
album.
Released a burger.
Is that what you do?
Not an album.
How you do it?
As you do.
As you do, you release a burger, and that's what we did.
With Almost Famous,
because they were a hip new joint in the day. Like, they had just come out. And so we pulled some strings there, and they made us like a, what was
I,
it?
I think the guy from Almost Famous liked the band as well, so that kind of helped. Yeah,
did he?
I'm not sure
I've ever met anyone that really likes the band. In the sense that everyone who ever likes us or ever kind of notices us, whether it's at Satan's or Morrison's or, you know, those are the usual two places now. they always know someone else that knows one of us. You know, right. It's always like, oh yeah, I know the person that you went to school with, so that's why I like you. Not for any actual artistic merit.
Never listen to any music.
Just to stipulate again, no artistic merit there.
So it was a gobbler burger. It had like a wild boar sausage because it was out of touch in the wild.
It sold
out on the night, which is good.
Well, nice probably to sell out something.
Yeah, Duncan, I'm so glad you said that and not me.
Yeah.
You might not
a record store day release.
You might not sell out the Brits, but then burgers are flying boys. And then the second time, for the fourth album, Oh Shudder, we released... we released a football match. we sponsored our non-league hometown heroes, West Didsbury and Cholton FC.
Yes, you did, yeah.
And that was farcical in its own sense, because the plan was that they were going to walk out on the pitch to the latest single at the time, which was Decided Knowledge.
But all they had to use was like a USB stick reader.
It was so complicated.
It was a really convoluted, like quite technical media system for a ninth tier football club.
Yeah.
But it was
and it was stuck on like random repeat, wasn't it? So they couldn't actually pick a track. All they could do was stick the USB stick in, press
and whatever
play.
Came out.
And so they walked onto the pitch to our Kate Bush ballad.
Given Thing, you know.
The last game, getting right.
It's like, and they lost 3-0. You guys do not want to know what this song is about. Did they lose 3-0?
Yeah.
And then we had a penalty shootout at half time.
Shocking.
And the saddest part was we brought our 3G boots for that. And me and you kicked it right into the keeper's hands.
Yeah.
Me and you just chipped it right into his
hands. I skied one over the top.
Yeah.
Did you?
Yeah, it was
a lowly game, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And then the last time we did a gimmick.
Yeah.
A lovable gimmick. We went go-kart racing. And that was nice.
I thought that was good. It was a bit more inclusive. It's not. It wasn't like, look at us. Look what we're doing.
Yeah.
You know, we invited people along. And they could come and race us in electric go-karts.
Yeah. And I think there's something, because you have the insurance waivers as well with that. So when you're signing your life away, it's actually quite, it's quite sexy. I like that.
Yeah.
I mean, bit of danger.
They just had the album played on repeat, didn't they? Which was horrible.
That was so peckhead.
Like 4 hours.
Yeah. You're right.
That was a bit much.
That was a bit much.
But do we regret any of those things? Like, should we have? Is it necessary for us to do that sort of thing?
I think for us it probably is necessary. Like for that campaign week when you're really pushing the album. I mean, like I think from the burger thing, like we haven't done anything before that, but the burger thing, like it did help because
the burger thing worked.
It was Vice, wasn't it?
Yes.
Vice got interviewed.
It was the first like positive Vice article we'd had.
Go on, Andy. Would you like to give the good people the Vice review of the Fragrance single from our second album?
Well, it was just three words.
Yeah.
Beautifully presented on their website. Pointless indie music.
Which is actually going to be our sponsorship board at West Disbury Cholton next season. Dutch Uncle sponsor West Disbury Cholton.
It's like my signature on the bottom of my emails.
Vice magazine.
Pointless indie music.
So what is this week's lowlight?
We're going to do two, I think. We're going to do the quick one and the slightly longer one. So the quick one, Rob, do you want to go for it?
We were just discussing before how when Out of Touch in the Wild came out. And
our third album.
Yeah, and It got to number 83 in the charts, and for us,
that was a big whoop.
This was a highlight, and we were like, this is it.
We're
and,
on you know, the map, yeah, baby.
And then, like, our good friends Delphic released their album the following week, and their album got to number 77, and for them, that was the worst thing that had ever happened.
Not laughing at them, just laughing at the situation.
The situation is like, like the comparison is like, so they pretty much split up then, didn't they?
Oh, like, yeah, pretty much.
But we were like, this is a platform for us. Yeah, we've arrived. We've made it.
We've made it.
Yeah, and James, we know you've listened to the first one. If you listen to this one, apologies about that. We're not, you know, we're not tearing anything here. About that situation. It was just it was just a remarkable reality check for all of us, I think.
But yeah, second low light. Well, Steve Reich, Robin, you tell the story.
Well, I mean, you can't say it's a low light. We met Steve Reich, so that is one of the high points of my life, really. You know, meeting him was amazing. Like,
yeah.
I think it was the deal that we made. Like, so basically, we met Steve Reich because we'd borrowed some of his motifs to create EXO.
We'd ripped him off.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say, you're being very diplomatic.
I am. And to be fair, he takes 70% of the royalties.
Did
so
you take 70? Has that changed? Oh, blimey. Time does fly. He does, doesn't
he? The main thing was that Steve Reich heard our arrangement of Electric Counterpoint and he approved. And he was happy to take his 70% and meet us.
He sounds so bitter.
I mean, it corresponded with his 70th birthday. And a performance of Music for 18 Musicians, which is one of the best pieces ever written. And
we had a lovely box seats at the Royal Albert Hall.
We'd listened to the whole thing pretty much. And it was like a really good experience just to be there and watch that being performed.
Well, the two
and
pieces clapping music and Electric Counterpoint before 18 Musicians.
Yeah.
But sort of at the end of it, when we'd sort of, you know, gathered our thoughts and, you know, but at the end of the piece, it was like a really... really nice experience up until realised that someone had dropped the most horrendous fart.
Yeah, and there was no breeze in that building.
Like, yeah, really, because we were in that box.
This is the grandest moment I'll probably ever have, and someone's just cut the worst fart. And I was really going under as well with that piece. Like, Music for 18 Musicians is not for the faint-hearted. You ever try and listen to that in the bath? Do not. Like, I tried to familiarise myself with it again. Never had a good time with that track, to be honest. Either going under in the bath or someone's just cut in the worst fart.
It was, my response from it was like, wow, that stinks.
One of the best things about that was, because we were meeting Steve Reich that night, we'd all dressed up for it.
We looked like we were playing nine holes of golf.
Cobbled together the worst suits ever.
We really felt that suits and polo shirts worked that evening.
We had quite a poor selection of suits. Tesco suits were out. And Pete had donned quite a fancy centre parting for the evening.
One and only time he's ever done that. Have we got the picture? Can we tweet the picture?
Oh, we can do.
We will find the picture of us meeting Steve Reich and Pete Centre Park.
I remember the conversation in the travel lodge, obviously. It's like, what do you think? This it looks all right. What does it need? I know. Centre Park. Love it. There's only one photo, and we look like pure shit.
Yeah, so what should have been a highlight was kind of a low light.
And that's your lot for this episode of Chips of Chilton. If you want to get in touch with us, recommend us some chips, it's at Chips of Chilton on Twitter. If you want to go to the band directly, it's at Dutch Uncles. Thanks a lot for listening, and hopefully we'll see you again next time.